Good morning, everybody. Welcome once again to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk Live. You can find us, powertalklive.com. Any of our past shows, you can find us, solomononblast.com. They're up there. This week, given that yesterday was Earth Day, and we want to take a look at what the reality is with regards to Earth Day, using some of the wisdom of Solomon, as we always do, because Solomon's wisdom wasn't just for people and interacting with people. It actually says in 1 Kings that Solomon gave God wisdom and great insight and breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. And in referencing it, it says that he spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005, and he spoke about plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. And from all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. So Solomon had a lot of wisdom for other things, including obviously plant life, the earth, and what it's all about. So we're going to take a look at some of the current events that this confused culture looks or believes with regards to the earth, especially given that yesterday was Earth Day. And we've got a five-minute clip here that we're going to play, another one of these Prager University clips that kind of gives you some thoughts with regards to the whole climate change and aspect of global warming. So we'll play that, and then we'll come back and break it down and discuss it.
I'm an atmospheric physicist. I've published more than 200 scientific papers. For 30 years, I taught at MIT, during which time the climate has changed remarkably little. But the cry of global warming has grown ever more shrill. In fact, it seems that the less the climate changes, the louder the voices of the climate alarmists get. So let's clear the air and create a more accurate picture of where we really stand on the issue of global warming, or, as it is now called, climate change. There are basically three groups of people dealing with this issue. Groups one and two are scientists. Group three consists mostly at its core of politicians, environmentalists, and media. Group one is associated with the scientific part of the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC Working Group One. These are scientists who mostly believe that recent climate change is primarily due to man's burning of fossil fuels, oil, coal, and natural gas. This releases CO2, carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere, and they believe this might eventually dangerously heat the planet. Group two is made up of scientists who don't see this as an especially serious problem. It's the group I belong to. We're usually referred to as skeptics. We note that there are many reasons why the climate changes, the sun, clouds, oceans, the orbital variations of the Earth, as well as a myriad of other inputs. None of these is fully understood, and there is no evidence that CO2 emissions are the dominant factor. But actually, there is much agreement between both groups of scientists. The following are such points of agreement. One, the climate is always changing. Two, CO2 is a greenhouse gas without which life on Earth is not possible, but adding it to the atmosphere should lead to some warming. Three, atmospheric levels of CO2 have been increasing since the end of the Little Ice Age in the 19th century. Four, over this period, past two centuries, the global mean temperature has increased slightly and erratically by about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit or 1 degree Celsius. But only since the 1960s, have man's greenhouse emissions been sufficient to play a role? Five, given the complexity of climate, no confident prediction about future global mean temperature or its impact can be made. The IPCC acknowledged in its own 2007 report that, quote, the long-term prediction of future climate states is not possible, end quote. Most importantly, the scenario that the burning of fossil fuels leads to catastrophe isn't part of what either group asserts. So why are so many people worried, indeed panic-stricken, about this issue? Here's where Group 3 comes in, the politicians, environmentalists, and media. Global warming alarmism provides them, more than any other issue, with the things they most want. For politicians, it's money and power. For environmentalists, it's money for their organizations and confirmation of their near religious devotion to the idea that man is a destructive force acting upon nature. And for the media, it's ideology, money, and headlines. Doomsday scenarios sell. Meanwhile, over the last decade, scientists outside of climate physics have jumped on the bandwagon, publishing papers blaming global warming for everything from acne to the Syrian civil war. And crony capitalists have eagerly grabbed for the subsidies that governments have so lavishly provided. Unfortunately, Group 3 is winning the argument because they have drowned out the serious debate that should be going on. But while politicians, environmentalists, and media types can waste a lot of money and scare a lot of people, they won't be able to bury the truth. The climate will have the final word on that.
Okay, so that's kind of the premise for what we're going to talk about, and we'll break down that his discussion points and get more into it as to, is man really the cause of climate change and all of the disasters that could occur on the earth? We'll come back after this quick break with more of Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk Live. We're back with more of Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk Live. Climate change, Earth Day yesterday, Earth Day plus one today. So is it all about the catastrophe that they're pointing out? In that video, he talked about the fact that there's really three different groups of people involved in this whole discussion. There's scientists that believe in climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it, scientists that don't, and then the other group of politicians, environmentalists, and the media. And he really indicated that that's the group that's making this whole thing out to be a catastrophe, because he said, he pointed out that there's agreements between the scientists that the climate is always changing. And gee, I don't even know if you have to be a scientist to be able to figure that one out.
That what Bob Dylan said. Bob Dylan said, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, you know?
Right. And the fact that CO2 does have an impact, the fact that CO2 since 1960 has had some impact on the increase in temperature, and the fact is that both scientific groups agree that temperature has increased, and the fact that long-term prediction is not possible. So both groups actually make that have that with in an agreement. But the part that neither one of them, of the scientific groups, support is the scenario that it's going to be catastrophic. Yet that's what we get from the media, the culture, that that is what's going to happen. And so this whole global warming, climate change thing is going to be a catastrophe for the world. Now, the question is man really the cause of all this?
And I think this is where the controversy really lies, is many people are not, although you can, obviously, you can factor in some realities that you get 2-3 million people together in the same metro environment. You're going to have a warmer temperature. You're going to have to make electricity. You're going to have incandescent bulbs. Obviously, the question is whether this is creating a world weather crisis based on that alone. All of those things are man-made. And I think this is the crux, is that they want to create a sense of alarm that causes every other issue to go to the back burner, where all resources are mustered toward this end of the green revolution, the green energy revolution. And it's not that man should always seek a better version of what he has. It's that they're trying to basically just hold up the treasuries of the governments of the world and saying, you must do this. This is the most important issue. And since we are claiming we've taken responsibility for it, then it's just a matter of us just making this priority number one.
Yeah, because, and I think that is the case, that there is an impact from man, but how significant is that in this whole thing? And how accurate are these numbers that they're bringing out, and how many dollars get spent in trying to resolve this particular problem?
In the piece that we played, he states their premise, and so this is what's faulty. It's not the impact of man on the environment, which is obviously a factor, being that man is the greatest life force on the planet,
right.
If I can use that phrase. But that they believe that man is a destructive force acting upon nature. That's based, and so that's a completely different idea than Las Vegas, Nevada, creating, you know, 4 more points in temperature because of all the lights on the strip. I mean, that's a different idea completely. That somehow what they're really saying is that man has to be stopped, which is incredibly suicidal, if you think about that, being that these are men saying it. These are not dogs and cats, you know, proposing these ideas.
Right. And I went back to some of the news articles from the early 70s when this whole Earth Day actually got started. Earth Day got started in 1970, and then the United Nations picked up on it and made it April 22nd as the day for Earth Day. And at that point in time, the real worry was the covering or the blanketing in the sky from pollution causing not global warming, but an ice age. And there was actually an article written April 9th, 1971, from the Washington Post that said, U.S. scientists sees new ice age coming. And in the article, it said, they had a computer program developed by a gentleman by the name of Dr. James Hansen that was studying the optical properties of the clouds of Venus, and they applied that same program to make a sophisticated calculation of the fuel dust sunlight scatter properties. So all of this dust in the atmosphere from fuel they found no need to worry about the carbon dioxide fuel burning puts into the atmosphere. So back then, they didn't even believe carbon dioxide fuel burning had any impact. The fuel particles were what they did need to worry about, because that was the largest single source of sulfur dioxide, which they believed at that point in time that it would cause a new ice age that would, and this is from the article, says it would flood the world's coastal cities and further lower temperatures to build up new glaciers that could eventually cover huge areas. So that was the concept back in the 70s, the early 70s, when all this kicked off. And suddenly, now we're in an environment where it's no longer an ice age, but it's global warming that's causing the problem, and we're going to burn the planet up. But I think in both cases, they're looking at it as this is a catastrophic event, and in neither case, I think, are we really dealing with a catastrophic event. Now, is it man-caused? I think part of that is definitely, the answer is definitely a yes in that situation, but not to the extent that they seem to be predicting throughout all of these articles and books.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. In the Daily Caller, they had an article yesterday about seven predictions from Earth Day that were just dead wrong. And I realized that reading this, these were the original Y2K alarmists, because basically they put everything around the year 2000. All this bad stuff was supposed to happen. Even before there were personal computers, they predicted that unless they dealt with, we dealt with it, civilization would end between 15 and 30 years in 1970. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I don't know. Maybe the 9/11 terrorists were being prompted by some of these ideas. And then they also predicted that 100 to 200 million people would be starving to death within, the next 10, like all the way into the 80s.
Right.
Basically, here's the point. It was all alarmism.
Right.
So it's not the rational discussion of, hey, you know, there are some ways to address the environment, to address food concerns. It's all alarmism. Everything is, it's the end of the world. And if we don't do something today and direct all of our resources this way, you know, the world's coming to an end. The sky's falling.
And that's what Dr. Richard Lindzen pointed out in that video clip, or that clip from Prager University, is that it's the extremism associated with it. And he actually referred to these people as if from a religious point of view. Well, and I think that is part of it, is that when you don't have a true religion, you create one to fill that void.
Yeah, it's radicalism. It's a radical idea, a radical theory, and they want us to take a radical measures to embrace their radical theory. And these people have achieved positions of power and authority, and it's not the, like you said, the discussion anymore. It's just about either you embrace this radical theory or else you're in trouble. You know, another prediction was urban dwellers would have to wear gas masks in order to survive air pollution. Now, I remember L.A. in the 70s. I was a small kid, but I do remember the smog, the gray skies, and the smoke just sitting over Los Angeles and, you know, in Southern California. I remember that going through there. And it was very real. It looked like a foggy day, and you realize it wasn't fog at all. It was smog.
Yeah, it was the dirt color. And that's kind of, I think, where this whole aspect of the ice age coming about was, because of the amount of smog was going to filter out the sun and lower the Earth temperature. But, again, it's in those isolated areas. Now,
I've heard ice age is being brought about by warming ocean currents. And certain parts of the ocean at certain depths are colder, and bringing about changes in currents to cause an ice age. That's the ice age argument I've heard.
That's a different one.
Whether that would happen, I don't know, but that's the one I've heard.
Yeah, because the ocean only increases in temperature for a certain depth from all of this so-called global warming. It doesn't really get below a certain level in the ocean because water is such a good insulator and it takes so much energy to increase the temperature of it. Land masses and whatnot are much easier to increase temperature on, but not the ocean. So there's still a whole undercurrent beneath the ocean of much, much colder water, obviously. And so how they can bring all these predictions
together. Well, here's my point. I mean, you know, well, L.A. today is far better than it was in 1970.
I think I heard that one from the Al Gore's movie, Unbelievable Truth or whatever, and then he sold that company to an oil firm or something.
Yeah, so. But I agree.
The inconvenient truth.
Yeah, that was it, yeah. And then I think that whole thing got sold to some Middle Eastern.
But I like your title better, The Unbelievable Truth. is actually a better title.
Yeah. And I think you're right, Fred, in that there were problems. I saw that back east. Lake Erie was a dead lake at one point, practically. There were fires on the lake. It's a much shallower lake than all the rest of the Great Lakes, so it has a better chance of warming. And when it warms, they get a lot of algae that basically suffocates the lake. But there were a lot of industrial waste and whatnot due to large industrial development in the 60s. But the lake was restored. They cleaned it up, became a much back to its original state. It was one of the most prominent walleye, which is one of the bigger, more popular fish from the Great Lakes, the walleye. It was one of the biggest walleye fishing areas in the country on Lake Erie. So there were problems. People have addressed those problems and taken the steps to restore things to their natural state.
And it seems to be effective. Here's another example. I used to started going to Mexico City somewhere around 1990 on a regular basis, you know, would visit. And when I first visited, it was horrible. I mean, it was like one of the worst places I'd ever been for pollution in my entire life. The air, it's about 7,500 feet high, I think. But the air, it was just, filled with smoke and everything you could imagine. I think they said they had 7 million cars at that time. And it was just horrible. Kids would wear respirator masks on the way to school. It was a routine thing.
So that was true regards to the comment that people would have to be wearing gas masks.
Well, it wasn't exactly the whole, World War I mask that they wore on the front lines. But the thing about it is what I had not visited for many years until recently again. And the air was probably 75-80% cleaner than it was then, and it was pretty amazing. And what they explained to me is they had taken different steps, and you could only drive your car on certain days of the week. And they really applied themselves to the problem, and they did a fantastic job of cleaning up the air. And I'm talking about one of the worst settings on earth for pollution. Mm-hmm. So it shows you that, you know, these things could be problems at any given time. Basically, what Earth Day is based on, a snapshot of 1970.
Right.
And they extrapolated forward. And like a lot of bad science, you extrapolate forward and you realize there's so many other variables in play that are at work to clean things up, to purge things, to recreate itself. Life is amazing. I think this is what they're missing.
It's durable.
Life is – it's amazing. It's durable.
Yeah.
It has the ability to keep – coming back in fresh ways that we just can't anticipate until it happens.
Right. And like life being able to come back, we'll be able to come back to more Solomon on Blast today, right after we take this quick break. So we'll come back and continue discussing the aspects of climate change.
Yeah.
All right, we're back with more Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk Live, and we're discussing the impacts of man's impact on the climate and whether or not we can really have a large impact on it. One of the things that I was thinking about was really natural impacts on the climate and how much more they seem to be in terms of affecting things than man at times. The thing that comes to mind immediately is Mount St. Helens, of course. You know, I remember back in 1980, that was a huge media event. And you look at the amount of ash that it created. I think they said it was the equivalent of 1,000 or 1,600 Hiroshima bombs. And you have to ask yourself, if that's a natural occurrence, you know, how can we come even close to creating the same level of impact as individuals on the planet over time when a natural occurrence on the planet can do something like that so quickly?
Yeah, the Mount St. Helens, I remember that too. The assumption was that the devastation and the destruction that Mount St. Helens endured would take decades and decades and maybe even centuries in order for there to be resurgence of life back to the way it used to be. I remember the discussions. How long is it going to take? How long is this going to sit here? Whether they had to even, with government initiatives, do things to kind of cultivate, bring back, clean up, or whatnot. But it's not exactly how it worked out.
No, and there's pictures out there. If you take a look at the aerial or satellite photographs from when it occurred in 1980 to recent photographs, basically about 30 years, it's amazing. The restoration of the plant life and everything else from what was essentially, I think Jimmy Carter made the comment when he flew over it, that it looked like a lunar landscape, that it was so barren and devastated. And now there's definitely still a hole on top of the mountain, but the green areas have considerably encroached upon what was effectively a dead landscape.
Yeah, National Geographic had a great article on Mount St. Helens a few years ago. It could be up to five. I can't exactly remember. But one of the things that they detailed in that article was what happened to Spirit Lake, which sits on top of Mount St. Helens.
Right.
And they said before the volcano, Spirit Lake was completely polluted. I mean, they said that not only were there just trash and, you know, cans, and probably not just aluminum cans, tin cans going back, beer cans, whatever, but there were cars, there were vehicles. They threw everything. People dumped their trash in it and just let it go. And it was a very, very dirty lake that people didn't even like to, fish in anymore. And there was something about the devastation of the volcano that completely restored Spirit Lake to a pristine lake. You're talking about, recovering Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
This natural disaster completely restored this lake, and it's a beautiful place again. And we're just talking 30, 35 years. We're not talking about centuries and ice ages, you know?
And there was a more recent earthquake, the one that occurred back in April of 2010, and that one, which country was that one in? I can never remember whether it was Iceland. It was fairly recent, and that one shut down because of the cloud, shut down all of European airline travel and everything else. And the funny part about that one, when you look at the news media reports, they said, well, the actual impact is going to be pretty minimal on this because the fallout and everything will end up on the ground, and then rains and whatnot will wash it away, and there won't be a big problem associated with it. Well, my question is, why is it that can have that kind of result? The impact from the volcano can easily be washed away, but they don't apply that same logic to the impacts of things that are man-made. They can easily dismiss the ones that are natural, but they don't want to take that same approach. And the things we're talking about show that there can be the ability to recover, and in a fairly short amount of time, when you look at things like Mount St. Helens and Lake Erie, that they can be recovered. But they don't want to bring that out because it doesn't fit within the agenda of man is causing this and we've got to stop it.
Well, the alarmist point of view likes to take the position that you keep adding things up without any other variables impacting the equation. They have a very narrow way of doing the math, you know. If this keeps happening, then that will keep happening and whatnot. And so you come up with these conclusions that are really not realistic because there are other factors that they don't want to acknowledge in play.
Right.
And, you know, like they always say, you know, don't confuse the argument with the facts. I mean, just right. I've already figured this out, and this is how it's supposed to go. And, you know, just, you know, for example, how long have we been hearing about crude oil? Remember?
Oh,
the gas lines of the 70s?
Right.
And you, like, oil shortage, and, you know, all the teachers in school were telling you, well, crude oil is running out. I remember being, like, 9 years old. Just buying it, like, wow, this, what are we going to do?
Right.
And when we get old and you see the gas lines and you're like, wow, man, it's coming down. It's coming down fast. And then you realize it never was the case. They said we would be out by the year 2000.
Right. And I think there's another religious aspect to that. There's a whole group of people believe there is a, quote, peak oil aspect to the world's oil supply. That we're going to reach that peak oil where from that point forward, our supplies are going to continually decline until we end up with nothing left. And I think that's what a lot of these alarmists are saying is that, oh, we've got to resolve this problem before it becomes, you know, a disaster. But again, you know, don't confuse the argument with the facts along that line. Richard Feynman, who was one of the people that helped during the Manhattan Project, World War II, with the atomic bomb, he made the comment at one point. He said, it doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is, it doesn't matter how smart you are, if it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong. And I think that's what we're seeing, is that they can come up with all these theories, they can say that they're smarter than anybody else, but the actual results don't align with what they're claiming. So it's wrong, in effect. And so I think that's part of this whole thing.
Well, it's the agenda. Again, going back to the piece that we heard in the beginning, where he talks about there's a reality to man's impact, you know,
there
obviously.
Is. Right. We don't deny that part of it.
I mean, how can you, being that human beings are, again, the most impacting force of nature? There is. But the question is it producing all these alarmist results that they're trying to push, that, and from those results leverage and demand control over the, you know, the treasuries of the world for this problem, and redirect all of you know, science and all the other corresponding resources into all these green energy solutions. Now, let me just say that everybody's for a better solution, a better way to do everything, cleaner environment. I don't think anybody's against that.
And I think that's what capitalism does. It provides the most efficient solution for
Absolutely.
A problem.
In other words, if you can come up with an electric car that can get 500 miles on one charge,
I guarantee people will be.
And there you go. You're competing
right.
with the potential of a full gas tank. I mean, it's pretty simple. But the idea that you have to stop everything and use the force of government to redirect people into another path is, you know, it's really what I like David Horowitz's phrase, a totalitarian solution, that you think you need to make government into God in order to so the people will finally do everything, quote unquote, correctly.
Yeah, and to me, it's, are we willing to question the logic of the culture or the logic of these alarmists? Because as soon as you start questioning it, then you can see where the holes are in their argument. What would they have us do? Return to bicycle transportation for everything, or horses instead of driving cars? What is their real approach? Okay, maybe it's electric vehicles, but there's still a need.
I have a point on that. It's actually not environmental. But I just read a study that a lot of metropolis centers that remove cars for streets and open up pedestrian walkways spur business. It's almost economically sound to reduce cars in urban areas for shopping.
And that may be the case in urban areas, but when you start doing that to people that don't live in the urban areas and they live in suburban areas or they live in the rural areas, what...
Or they have to commute.
Right. Also, another part of that study, a lot of my generation are not getting their licenses years later. My roommate got his license this year.
And
he's
how old is
22
he?
Now.
And I've seen that with a lot of, it's just, of these young kids.
That didn't necessarily
buses,
mean he wasn't
trains.
Driving.
Yeah, he wasn't driving. Yeah, I was driving him here and there, but he was mainly walking.
So the thing
it's interesting.
Is,
though,
like, for example, I lived in the San Francisco area for years, and you take BART downtown and you walk around, you know, do your thing. But there's a lot of people that commute. And so it's okay if you live there, but you know how expensive it is to live in an urban area where you just
yeah,
take your bike out
absolutely.
And go wherever you want to go?
Dave called – one of the listeners called us, what was it, 2 weeks ago and said, what, $4,000 for a studio?
In order for me, myself, to live in an urban area, I wouldn't be able to afford my car.
Absolutely, and you definitely would not – your car payment would be dedicated to your rent payment. But and not just that, it's just that a lot of it's not practical for a lot of people to live there, and for a lot of reasons.
I don't think it's a solution for everybody. I just thought it was an interesting point right. that in some
but,
cases,
you
less
know,
cars are
you're right. I mean, the less amount of cars, the better. It just makes it.
And obviously, you need trucks to get the food there and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And you know the way UPS and all these people have to double park, and you know it's pretty astonishing to see some of the way even trucks that. Have to unload their stuff at Safeway. It's pretty astonishing what they have to do right. in a place like that.
But the point I was going to get to here was that all of these decisions have an impact, and a lot of times they don't consider the overall impact, because if you really start restricting or increasing taxes related to fuel to try and force people to do something, you don't know what the unintended consequences are. A lot of times higher fuel costs due to either forcing higher taxes so people don't drive are going to affect typically the poor people the most, those that have no way of accommodating for these changes. Higher food costs because, you know, fuel costs are going to be higher. That impacts the poor the most. And so there's a lot of economic impacts that they don't look at, and I think this whole alarmist theory with regards to we've got to stop this does have the biggest impact on those people that they claim that they're trying to help the most out there, which is the poor people. And we see that in countries like Africa. If you don't have the ability to have clean water, clean environment, sanitation, those two things are probably the largest impact on people's health. And especially in the poorer countries. So what has typically in this country allowed for clean water and good sanitation? And that is energy, right? The ability to have efficient energy to process the water, deliver it, sanitation the same way. Now, if you're saying that we can't allow that to happen in these poorer countries, then you're basically dooming them to an environment where they won't have clean water and they won't have good sanitation. And the death rate in these countries is significant from diseases associated with those compared to death rate from whether or not the temperature increased by 2 degrees. So I think when you look at it, the overall impact, it's much more significant than
right.
they want to point
the
out.
The practical impact.
Right.
And that's where the free market... That's why you can ride the free market to prosperity. Not that there's not all kinds of crony capitalism and gangsterism associated with it, but by and large, it will be the most efficient way to get somewhere because people have to make a profit in order to make it worth their while.
Absolutely.
And you get these people out front, they're going to carry it further based on their own ability to prosper. And, you know, it's was Adam Smith and those guys that talked about, you know, this commonwealth of people doing whatever they got to do to prosper, and understanding so does your neighbor.
Right.
And you just work together in order to get something done.
And typically the growth in wealth has allowed for countries like the United States to be the most generous countries with regards to charity towards these other poor nations. I mean, we talked about that last week and the whole charitable giving thing. There is a significant impact that can be made if you allow the market to work the way it will in a free market versus one that's controlled and focused by the government.
Now, let me just kind of change the direction of our discussion a little bit before we run out of time. We were discussing on how do these thoughts in any way relate to something Solomon would have said or understood about this kind of problem? Or would this even be a non-pollution, let me use that word, be a non-biblical issue?
And I think at the beginning I talked a little bit about Solomon's view on the world and everything. And he says in Ecclesiastes 1:4, one generation passes away and another comes, but the earth abides forever. But I think the real impact that we're looking at is man's impact on the world based on his actions. And I think the actions that Solomon points out a lot of times that causes problems is the activity of sin, right?
Now, you look at the word pollution in the Old Testament, that's really where you see it. And the Hebrew prophets had a few things to say about pollution. I'm just going to make a couple of references here. Jeremiah was talking about the Israelites replacing their worship of God with the image of Baal. And this is how he put it. He said, they have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. So they associated pollution with a spiritual condition.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I think that's the part that we don't see in this world and in this argument is we see it from a physical, or the world, the culture is seeing it from a physical point of view. And I think there's a much bigger problem that if we ask the question, is man causing climate change? Is man causing the global catastrophe? And I think if you look at it from a spiritual point of view, the answer would have to be,
and that's what they yes. They implied the same thing. Here's another statement he made. He said, you have polluted, he uses the word again, the land with your vile sexual immorality. And so he also uses the idea of pollution and the land and how it impacts
probably one of the most famous stories in the Bible that people talk about a lot, Sodom and Gomorrah. And it says, we were talking about acid rain and everything else. Well, in the Bible it says, the Lord rained down sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah. He overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. Now, what was the reason for that happening?
It's kind of that idea. And so, again, here's Jeremiah continues. He says, for the land is full of adultery. It lies under a curse. The land itself is in mourning. Its wilderness pastures are dried up. So he's not just speaking metaphorically. He's saying it's actually being physically impacted by this impasse that the dwellers in covenant there's a red bordered letter of delinquency.
Right.
and he's saying I'm shutting off the blessing here. Right. Until we deal with some of these problems, some of these issues.
And so I think the question at the beginning is, does man have an impact? We have to say yes, but I don't think the people are looking at what the real impact, the source of the impact is.
Well, at least it's a factor.
It's definitely a factor.
You have to ask yourself, okay, if you really believe in God, then at what point is God saying, I'm not blessing this? And, I mean, in other words, is there any influence or impact at all? And, you know, Moses, he said, again, he uses the word pollution, you shall not pollute the land. where you are, for blood defiles the land. So this is Moses talking, you know.
He wasn't talking about throwing your, you know, your gum wrapper out the window at that point.
He's saying that there are deep moral, ethical, and spiritual factors that also weigh in as variables in the whole equation.
Yeah, and so I think if you look at it from the wisdom of Solomon, you see that there's a much bigger impact on the environment, and that impact is coming from man, but it's coming from the things that he does in relationship to God and the moral laws that were put in place, more so than, you know, the impact that we have with regards to driving our car back and forth to work or anything else along those lines. And I think that if you start looking at it and looking at other stories in the Bible, you see that over and over. The flood was a significant event, obviously, but again, it was related to man's wickedness on the earth. And so it's a spiritual, much more than a physical impact that man has in terms of really impacting the climate, and it's bringing changes overall. So we're pretty much out of time. We're going to have to close out this segment of Solomon on Blast. But as always, until next week, keep thinking wisely.